Afternoon, Council.
Hey, please, the court, Your Honor. Prior to argument, I did want to introduce myself and Pro Hoc Council, as I understand is the protocol. My name is Seth Rydenberg. I'm an attorney at Young Conaway, Stargott & Taylor. I have with me today Michael Salzman and Russell Jacobs from the law firm of Hughes, Hubbard, and Reed. Both of the Mr. Salzman and Mr. Jacobs have been admitted pro hoc vici, and Mr. Salzman will be presenting the argument on behalf of the appellee today.
Welcome to Delaware, Council.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Pataglia.
Yeah, Your Honor, please.
May it please the court, my name is Victor Battaglia. I'm the attorney for the appellants in this case, Hans and Betty Trummer. I will not spend a lot of time detailing facts because I think they have been set out extensively, but there are some very important inferences to be drawn from the facts, and I will spend a good bit of time talking about those inferences. Your Honors, the Trummers are here because they were defrauded when they purchased what they were guaranteed was an authentic painting by noted American artist Frank Weston Benson. The painting was an absolute forgery. And there is no evidence in the record to contest the fact that this was not an authentic painting. It was a forgery that was clever enough to fool a reasonably prudent layman, but which was obvious upon examination by art professionals. Now, I will say, Your Honor, please, that the forgery was a good forgery, and so much so that when the art professionals looked at the painting, they could not tell it. It was only upon examination that it was revealed that it was a forgery. The evidence is uncontested that the Crommers had no way of knowing that they were the victims of a forgery until the report of a restorer to whom the painting was assigned for evaluation by Sotheby's in the year 2002. All of Christie's representatives and even the court below conceded as much. There was no way that they would have any independent knowledge of the fact that this was a forgery. Until the report of Simon Parks in 2002. The court, in denying the victims the protection of the time of discovery rule in this case, stated the issue as whether the inherently unknowable injury rule applies where an auction house sells an allegedly fake work of art to one who has no specific reason to question its authenticity until long after the statute of limitations has expired. In a remarkable, absolutely remarkable departure from precedent established by this court and affirmed time after time by this court. In a number of those cases, reversing a trial court grant of summary judgment just as we have. In that remarkable departure from precedent, Vice Chancellor denied the Crommers the protection of the time of discovery rule because they could have had an independent appraisal made of the purchase claim. First time anybody has seen anything like that in a Delaware time of discovery case. Interestingly enough, the Vice Chancellor cited in quoting from Weiss versus Park Benet Gallery for the proposition that a buyer at an auction assumes a greater risk than a buyer who purchases directly from the office, from the artist, and therefore cannot not be held to be blamelessly ignorant.
Now, is it your contention that any time that there's some expertise involved that the time of discovery rule should apply in a case? Because I mean, that could be rather broad in scope. It could apply to an automobile being sold or...
No, we don't make that argument at all, Justice Ridley. What we're saying is unless there is some reason to put the purchaser on notice or to raise a reasonable suspicion in his mind, then he has no duty to do anything. Your Honors, please, we've been through this with doctors, we've been through it with lawyers, we've been through it with surveyors, we've been through it with plumbers, and there are all situations where there is some special professional knowledge. And when I say professional, I don't mean doctor, lawyer, dentist. I mean somebody that practices a profession. And these are people that have specific knowledge in those areas. This court, and none of the lower courts in Delaware have ever even suggested that if there wasn't a reason, or there wasn't a suspicion raised by the buyer or by the person who's being served, if there was never a suspicion raised, then you're blamelessly ignorant. Nobody has said, hey, that doctor shouldn't have been able to get out of the case because any other doctor that examined this patient would have taken an x-ray and seen the hemostat that was left in the patient's stomach. Nobody has said, hey, the accountant should be set free, because any other accountant who looked at the bank's records in the Isaac Stover case, any other accountant would have seen and would have discovered what he did. It just is not the law of this state. What's really quite puzzling, frankly, is that the court below cited the Weiss versus Park Bernay case and cited it to say that there's some risk in buying at an auction. And that may be in New York. And that may be in some places in New York. What the court did not say in the Weiss case, and what the Vice Chancellor did not pick up and did not report on, was the court reported that there specifically was a disclaimer of any knowledge of the authenticity of the painting or the source of the painting. And that's one of the things that makes Weiss different from us. I'm not sure that legally it should make a difference in the context of this argument, but it is a different case than our situation, and we do not have to confront it here, because in our case there was no such disclaimer. There was, rather than a disclaimer, there was a complicated grading system where Christie's actually graded this painting. They had 11 grades of comfort that they give in evaluating the painting. Christie's graded this painting in their number one, their number one rating. Absolutely, no question.
Is that independent of the warranty, or was that part of the warranty, that grading?
I'm not sure I can answer that question. I don't honestly believe you can. If you have a guarantee, if you have an assessment made, if I'm going to buy something from somebody and they tell me that they guarantee it, and they guarantee it at this level, I'm not sure whether it's important, whether it's part of a warranty or part of simple inducement to buy something that the party wants to sell. So what you are looking at in this case is an absolute departure from any existing Delaware law. And the Vice Chancellor said that this was a case of first impression in Delaware. It's a case of first impression only because it's the first art case that we have seen. On the other hand, that there's no reason why somebody who sells you a fraudulent piece of art should be treated differently than somebody that fixes your septic system, or the doctor that treats an ailment that you have, or the accountant that takes care of your accounting purposes. Why would there be, I ask rhetorically, why would there be a special rule that would apply with respect to fraudulent sales of artwork? It doesn't hold together. It's not our law.
Let me interrupt. Assuming that you're correct and that there should have been some tolling of the statute of limitations, why wouldn't the time of inquiry notice have been sometime in 1999 when the existence of what appeared to be a duplicate of your client's painting was... your client learned that there was another one in this museum in Connecticut. Isn't that enough of an unusual circumstance to have put your client on notice that he'd better look into the authenticity of his own painting?
Your Honor, please, my clients were thrilled to death. They had found an American masterpiece that they were told by Christie's had rapidly increased in value. When they did a second appraisal in 1990, they then said its value was now $85,000. The fact that there's a second painting, similar painting, has been testified to by Mr. Cantor representing Christie's as not a basis for suspicion. As a matter of fact, Mr. Cantor said that the presence of the second painting would have confirmed his belief in the authenticity of what they sold. And the Crombers, when they saw the second painting, they had a photograph of the two of them. They sent them to the Resin A Committee, the votes, the Benson Resin A Committee, and the votes committee said, nothing to be concerned about. May well have painted it twice. What was suspicious? Why should their suspicion have been aroused at that time? I cannot think of a reason why it should not have been.
So you're saying that all the evidence of record indicates that finding the existence of a second painting that's almost identical hanging in a museum doesn't raise any suspicion as to the authenticity of your clients?
It's what both the litigants in this case have said, Your Honor, please. Both have taken that position. I would refer you to the Cantor affidavit. I think it's paragraph 14, where he talks about the fact that a similar painting would simply reinforce his belief in the authenticity of what he sold. There was another matter that was alluded to by the Chancellor, but not relied upon him. There was indication that the Chancellor said in the 1990s, the Cromers began researching this painting. That simply is a misread of a part of the petition for rescission, which did not say they researched this painting. In the 1990s, they were excited about Benson, and they wanted to find out who he was, and they wanted to find out what his paintings were. So they began researching Benson's paintings. And at no place did it ever suggest or anybody say that they began researching this painting. The Christie's picked up that misread, and they repeat the mistake in their brief, and they urge this court to deny us relief on the basis that the Cromers began researching this painting in the 1990s, and therefore the tolling should have ended by 1999, and the statute of limitation should have run 3 years after. This is simply not correct. The petition does not say that. The petition says just what I said, that the Cromers had a great interest in this wonderful American artist, and they began researching him and the artist's paintings. And it's hard to tell what effect that mistake by that misread by the Chancellor had. It's obvious that it excited Christie's because they have picked it up and they have run with it at two or three separate places in their briefing.
Mr. Battaglia, would you help me understand what role the so-called six-year warranty of authenticity has in your theory? What meaning would it have at all? Given your position,
if this were an action for breach of warranty, Mr. Chief Justice, I would think it might really threaten our being in the court. But this is not an action for a breach of warranty. This is an action for fraud. It's for an action for negligent misrepresentation and fraudulent concealment. So I don't think the fact that that they say we're going to warrant this for 6 years has any effect at all. And as a matter of fact, if you think about it, this is not a clock. It's not a washing machine. It's not a television set. And so you might expect that 6 years might make a difference with regard to appliances like that. But with a painting, I don't think so.
Well, let me ask my question a little differently. Does the existence of a six-year warranty of authenticity suggest to the buyer that the buyer should take any action in terms of an independent appraisal within 6 years?
Not unless the buyer has some reasonable suspicion that there has been a violation of the warranty within that period of time. I can think of no reason why it should have any impact at all on the buyer, Your Honor, please. Breach of warranty, you know, the UCC has that provision that you can't extend a tolling period for breach of warranty purposes beyond the 6 years, is my recollection. And that specific statutory provision has been called into play in some of the cases cited by my friends, but it has no application here. We're not dealing with that. We're dealing with fraud, we're dealing with negligent misrepresentation, and we're dealing with fraudulent concealment. Your Honor, there are a whole raft of absolutely fascinating legal questions that are behind this thing. Some of which I don't think need to be gone into by the court here today. For example, if I go to an art museum and they say, buy this painting, we guarantee its authenticity. We guarantee that the signature is authentic. We guarantee it. At that point, they say, okay, we're acting only as agent for the consignment. I think there's a very, very interesting legal question that maybe we'll get into in another case, but I don't think we need to get into it here. And that is, when somebody says to me, for purposes of inducing me to make a purchase, I guarantee for you the validity of this payment. Is he then acting as a joint agent for the buyer and seller? When he does something for me, what he's doing for me is guaranteeing the authenticity of this painting he wants me to buy. But I truly do not believe that we have to get into it at this stage in this case, Your Honor, please. I'd like to take a minute to talk about the fraud and the inferences of fraud. Time is fleeting on me, and I'm talking too much. Your Honor, fraud, obviously, is very seldom proved other than by circumstantial evidence, unless you've got a camera somewhere that is recording the device, unless you've got a confession, then you've got to prove it by circumstantial evidence. Now, I'm going to talk about things that are evidence that somebody at some later date may say, well, that's a possible inference, but there may be another possible inference. But I want to connect a whole series of these inferences to show you that there's a whole course of suspicious conduct here. First of all, Your Honor, please, we say that evidence that the representation was made with pretense of knowledge and tests and studies required for its knowledge were not done. We think that what happened here is that the people who worked for Christie's were absolutely entranced by the fact that this offering came from the Detroit Club, very prestigious club with very prestigious members. We think that the Provence actually blew them away. And we think as a result of that, they did absolutely nothing that they were supposed to do. And if you take a look at some of the deposition pages that we have cited at A48, A49, Ms. Force, for example, says, but with regard to the Spenson painting, what did the research consist of? I'm not sure that I don't recall doing specific research because we really didn't have, because of the provenance, the fact that it had gotten to the Detroit Club approximately at the time it was painted, part of the provenance. We didn't question it. We felt stylistically that it appeared to be the work of Frank Benson and obviously signed by Frank Benson. But, Your Honors, please, a forger is not going to make a painting, as we suggested in our brief, of the Mona Lisa with wearing Sony eyeglasses and a false mustache. A forger is going to try to make it look like the style of Benson. And this forger, we believe we know who it was, but he won't talk to any of us. But he did he was an artist himself, and he did one bang-up job. His job was so good that experts who looked at the painting on the wall, one expert walked into the Cromwell household and said, would you like to sell that painting for $250,000? And the Cromwell said, yeah, we'd be interested in that. And so he said, let me take it and examine it. Took it and examined it, came back the next week and said, forget it. Send it to Sotheby's. Didn't tell them any more than that. They sent it to Sotheby's. Sotheby's sent it to a restorer. The restorer looked at it under a black light, and he could tell that there were all kinds of abrasions, all kinds of signs of falsehood. And finally ended up by saying, one of the real options here is, this is where the bell rang. This is where the trail of inquiry began. One of the real possibilities here is that this is an absolute fraud, absolute fake. And it turned out, when the painting finally got to the Vos Committee, they confirmed that on the basis of style and painting. These are all things that an art professional has a responsibility to do. An art professional has the responsibility to examine a painting. My job is to look at a painting and appreciate it. And Christie's advertised their people as American art specialists. And Cantor, the principal witness for them, was the senior American art specialist. That's a special expertise. That's a special profession. And they represented to the Cromers, to anybody else that were candidates to buy that painting. This is an authentic painting. These people have been victimized, Your Honor, please. And to have Christie say, we're sorry, but you really, I guess you really couldn't have trusted us. It seems to me an unusual position for a world-renowned auction house. Your Honor, I see my yellow light is on, so I'm going to have to stop unless Your Honors have some specific question and ask for a couple of minutes to rebut. But we will rely on our other arguments in our brief.
Thank you, Mr. Taggart.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, my name is Michael Salzman. I'm from Hughes, Hubbard & Reed in New York, and I represent Christie's. First, I'd like to thank the court for affording me as an out-of-state lawyer the opportunity to argue on behalf of my client. First, I'd like to begin by addressing some of the questions that were posed by the court to my opponent. Justice Berger asked a question as to whether 1999 wasn't the relevant period to begin the statute running, even if the earlier toll existed. And as the court knows, the test there under the fraudulent concealment test is whether someone has been put off the trail of inquiry. And I submit that the what we saw was by inquiring of the Catalog Raisonne Committee, whether or not they were talking about Benson and Gemmell or not, they in fact were on the trail of inquiry at that point. So there was nothing to do but ask the Catalog Raisonne Committee. They did ask the Catalog Raisonne Committee. It was 1999. So the Vice Chancellor, I submit, was completely correct in restarting the clock at that point had ever stopped.
Let me be clear on this. It was in 1999 that the Cromers learned that there was a second painting that was virtually identical. But their argument is that did not put us on inquiry notice of anything because there was nothing to suggest that the fact that there was a second very similar painting meant that their painting might be a fake. And yes, the record does indicate that the Cromers were in contact with the organization that was cataloging all of Benson's artwork. But where is there something in the record that says, oh, I learned that there was a second painting. I became concerned that maybe that meant my painting was less than authentic, and so I was on notice. I mean, obviously, the person isn't going to say it in so many words, but the fact that they were in touch with this committee, if it did not include a concern about the authenticity of their artwork, how would that act as a toll?
Well, it would end the toll, I submit, Your Honor, because that's what the Catalog Raisonne Committee does. That's what the testimony is. They authenticate paintings. They decide whether to put it in the catalog or to exclude it from the catalog. That's the function of the committee, so that simply by saying, I have a painting, I inquire about it, will you put it in the catalog? They, in fact, were doing anything anyone would do at that point to determine whether it was authentic or not. Justice Ridgely asked whether the statement in the catalog of the gradings that this was a full attribution to Frank Weston Benson was different from the warranty of authenticity. And I think that gets to the heart of the matter. The answer is yes, that if one looks at the conditions of sale and the limited warranty in the catalog, they're in the appendix, you'll see that the name of the artist, if it's fully attributed, is the limited warranty. That's the six-year warranty with respect to authenticity. And I submit in response to the Chief Justice's question about how does the UCC play into this, that the entire case, frankly, is an end run around 2-725 of the UCC, which says a breach of warranty occurs when tender of delivery is made. Except that where a warranty explicitly extends to future performance of the goods and discovery of the breach must await the time of such performance, the cause of action accrues when the breach is or should have been discovered. So the UCC has its built-in provision for when the time of discovery rule applies. It's only when there's future performance, and that's not this case. The painting is what it always was, and the rule, as discussed in Rosen against Spanierman and the other cases from the Third Circuit, from the First Circuit, addressed that issue. The six-year warranty of authenticity was in the catalog. It was explicitly there. It was in the standard format that Christie's uses. 6 years ran a long time ago. It was 18 years until there was a lawsuit brought. Really, there were two questions presented by this appeal. First is whether there should be a fraudulent concealment tolling, and the second, was this inherently unknowable? With respect to the second, I would echo what I thought I perhaps heard in a question from Justice Ridgely, that if this case falls under the time of discovery rule, then any sale under the UCC can fall under it, and that what we would have, in effect, is a perpetual warranty, that if petitioners first came to inquire about the picture 18 years later, that would be the effect. If they didn't sell it, but instead passed it, gave it to their children or their grandchildren or someone 50 years later, they could come back to Christie's at that point and say the time of discovery rule means that even though this is a purchase of goods under the UCC, I have a claim now. And the UCC does not permit that, and artful pleading should not get you there. The Chancery Court dealt with the lack of scienter evidence, and I'll discuss that in a minute, and the Chancery Court correctly dealt with the inherently unknowable doctrine. It correctly cited courts, as I said, up and down the coast and across the country, Minnesota, New York, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania. They all say the same thing. The picture is on the wall. It's not going to later become a fake. It either is or it isn't fake when you buy it, and the warranty of authenticity for a painting is just like any other goods. In this respect, as everyone knows, the UCC governs many, many complicated sorts of goods, not just the television, not just consumer goods, any kind of goods, and the rule is the same with respect to all, that within the time by which the buyer has to determine whether the goods do or don't conform to the warranty begins upon purchase.
I'd like to ask you a question about fraudulent concealment. As I understand fraudulent concealment, that requires an affirmative act of concealment by a defendant, an actual artifice that prevents a plaintiff from gaining knowledge of the facts or some misrepresentation that is intended to put a plaintiff off the trail of inquiry. Is that the correct statement of the rule as you understand it?
Yes.
Well, isn't the plaintiff contending here that the process of immediately offering an appraisal and then renewing that appraisal was intended to basically put the plaintiff off the trail so they don't get their own appraisal or have another expert look at the painting? And therefore, that is the actual artifice that allows for a fraudulent concealment claim that at least requires a credibility determination at trial. What's wrong with that position?
What it amounts to is a restatement of what happened just a few minutes before. A few minutes before that occurred, there was the fall of the hammer, and there was a purchase of a painting that was at that time warranted to be by Frank Weston Benson. To come over and say, congratulations, and would you like something for your insurance records? It's just restating what had just occurred a few minutes before, and I submit, Your Honor.
But the allegation is that this was very unusual, isn't it? Isn't that at least the allegation?
That is the allegation. But it was a mere restatement of what had occurred only a few minutes before, and I submit that that by itself cannot put anyone off the path of inquiry as to as submitted, for example, in the Rosen against Bannerman case, that if you're getting assurances from the same person, you're not getting anything additional. There were subsequent appraisals in that case, and the Second Circuit and the District Court in that case said that did not constitute something separate and apart from the original act, and that the statute of limitations ought to run from the original time.
Was there an appraisal in that case?
There were appraisals in that case. Judge Leisure in the lower court discussed how that was a separate transaction and did not affect the analysis, albeit the analysis there was under the UCC provision, but it was the same question. It was still a long delay, and it was still a question of whether there should be a tolling. The original theory in this case, remember, Your Honor, why it was brought as a fraud case was that Christie's had learned between the first time the picture had been offered and the second time a few months later that it was not the Detroit Club as the consigner, but rather that this man, Purdy, had interposed himself in the chain of ownership and that Purdy was the one who could sign to Christie's. And that is in paragraph 17 of the original petition. As we know now, the evidence simply didn't bear out that speculation. Christie's was able to go back into its microfilm records, and lo and behold, it did find a check made out to the Detroit Club. A man at the Detroit Club, Mr. Booth, who gave an affidavit in the case, went up into the attic or the basement, as it may be, of the Detroit Club, went back the 18 years, and found the minutes of the Detroit Club in which it said that on the advice of Samuel Sachs, the director of the Detroit Institute of Arts, we recommend that Christie sell our Frank Weston Betson painting. And so the original theory, there might have been a fraud case, and it might have been an interesting one at that time, and we would have gotten into why Christie did or didn't deal with Mr. Purdy and so on, but that's not the facts. And the petitioners have had to resort, really, after that, to a grasping at straws to find, well, this could be interpreted as fraud or that. But the real theory died at the starting line. The unrebutted evidence is that the Christie's people acted in the way that they always act with respect to paintings of this kind. Provenance from the Detroit Club, when there was stark evidence that the artist had dealt directly with the club. Powerful, powerful evidence for 20th century art, and the affidavits of Cantor and Force say that when you have within the span of the lifetime of the people that the artist dealt directly with someone, that's the most powerful evidence, and they were entitled to rely on it here as they did many other times. My opponent concedes, if you want to deem it that way, a concession that this was apparently a great fake, if it is a fake, and of course we're not conceding that it's a fake except for purposes of this appeal, and we're comfortable with that for purposes of the appeal, but if it was a great fake, then how can there be fraudulent concealment here?
Well, as I understood his position, it's great enough to get by the layman, but not by someone of professional caliber.
Well, the evidence, there is no expert evidence on the other side that neither Mr. Parks nor anyone else came forward and said, oh, I easily said it was a fake. The report from Mr. Parks said, at first glance, it looks good. On second glance, it might be a fake. On third glance, well, maybe it's a bad touch-up. So there is no evidence of that. Mr. Vose and Mr. Highland from the museum, Mr. Vose was getting the catalogs back in 1986. He didn't come forward and say this is a fake. It was on public exhibition twice at Christie's. And no one came forward and said that it was a fake at that time. There's no reason to question Cantor and Force, who said they looked at it and they did a proper job. There's simply no evidence on the other side of the table or on the scale.
Isn't there some reference to a photograph of the original with a necklace? Or am I misunderstanding?
No, there is the Catalog Resume Committee, in pointing to their inference that, or their conclusion that the painting was a fake, in addition to relying on what they thought that our painting came through Purdy, they did point to that difference, but that itself is not a telltale because there was no way to go back and look at that time. There was no Catalog Resume Committee back in 1986. The New Britain, the picture that's in the museum in New Britain, was not known to Christie's or anybody else at that time. So it wasn't as though there was a book to look in and say, but the other, there's another, there is another one, or that the other one has a necklace. So there's nothing that's chargeable against Christie's. Christie's had a painting from the Detroit Club in the original frame with a plaque that said Detroit Club. It was signed, and there was evidence that the artist had dealt directly with the Detroit Club. I'd like now to talk about the ruling by the Chancery Court as to the attempt to amend the complaint and the negligent misrepresentation claim and the equitable fraud claim. Clearly, from a litigator's point of view, they came at the end of discovery because there was a recognition that there was that the Purdy theory was not bearing out, and but still in all, there was still a 3-year statute of limitations even for these claims, and they still require a toll. Negligent misrepresentation in New York does require a special relationship, and the cases that deal with artworks and art auctioneers make clear that an auctioneer does not have any such relationship with a buyer. The Boxley case says that, the real property case says that, the Rosen case says that in the district court, and they all rely on New York cases of more general application that say that a simple buyer-seller relationship does not create a special relationship. I think it's important for the court to keep in mind that contrary to what my opponent is arguing, Christie's was at arm's length from the petitioners. It was representing the seller. The cases, the time of discovery cases were all about someone hiring someone as an advisor, whether it be professional or it be a craftsperson, who is asked, give me your expertise, please do this on my behalf, whereas at an auction, it's a public auction. Keep in mind the circumstances. First there's a public viewing, then there's a public auction. The auctioneer is in the rostrum, and there's no the petitioner is at arm's length from Christie's. Christie's is not advising him, I think you should buy this one and not that one, I think this is a better choice for you, or anything like that. It's representing the seller. And for that reason, the time of discovery cases simply don't apply, nor should they, as the other cases recited, Rosen, Wilson, Firestone.
Does the fact of the appraisals create any special relationship?
Well, I don't think it does, Your Honor. Foxley is a perfect example of that, where there were luncheons, there were appraisals, there was confidence, and it's still buyer-seller. You should understand that. In this case, the second appraisal occurred after the statute of limitations had run anyway. In any event, we're still in a situation where the buyer is in a position, if he so chooses, to hire anyone in the world to go to Sotheby's, go to anyone else, go to Simon Parks, and ask their view. It's like the case in the Eighth Circuit, I submit, that we cited to, where someone just blindly relied on one advisor and who also had sold them the picture. And the court said, well, you can't just rely on the person who sold you the picture. That person is at arm's length from you. And so...
Were these appraisals paid for? Was there consideration?
Not
for either one?
They were gratuitous. I would just end by saying that contrary to what has been said before, the Isaacson case, the Coleman case, all those cases rely on a special character of the relationship between the professional and the client.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You, Your Honor.
You have 1 minute and 5 seconds, Mr. Patavi.
You'll
have to condense your 3 minutes into 1 minute.
Just a word. There were four experts who looked at this painting. One who wanted to get him $250,000 owing. And when we took it out and he examined it, he did what experts do. They examine it. I look at paintings. The experts examine it. Owens did it. Simon. His last name escapes me, but the restorer looked at it, and he examined it. He didn't look at it. He examined it. Bosch looked at it. Sotheby's looked at it, and they all said, "No, thank you." That's what should have happened here. These people, I don't say that they are evil people, that they set out to do bad, but what happened was they got caught up in the provenance, and they rested their whole case on that. They didn't do the examinations they were required to do. If they did, that they should have seen what all these other people did, and their failure in either case is absolute fraud, Your Honors, please.
Thank you, Mr. Patavi.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.